Hi, everybody. It's Monday. It's January, lost track, 3rd, 2022. It's 1 o'clock on Monday, and so, as usual, this is Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. We will get to Pirkei Avot. However, I've been in the midst of discussions over the past few days regarding an interesting question, which is unfortunately extremely pertinent within the Haredi and also within the modern Orthodox community, and perhaps within the larger, certainly traditionally oriented community. I don't think I have to go into the details of the nefarious behavior of the late Chaim Walder, who took his life last week out of whatever, manipulation or shame. I don't really want to get into the details of his misdeeds, or his crimes, I should say. More interesting to us, I think, at the moment, and less fraught, I think, is a question which arose, which I've actually had to confront on a number of occasions in the past 5 years, and that is the question of what is the fate of his books. Walder was a very successful author. He earned his reputation because of his acknowledged capacity to be able to address and express the needs of children and the inner life of children. Ironically or horrifically, he apparently was very, very good even at dealing with or expressing the needs or the fears or the pain of children who have been abused, even though he himself was a serial abuser of the most egregious sort. So the books are good. Everybody likes them. He created games, all kinds of therapeutic tools or tools that can be used in a therapeutic setting for children. It's especially, his books are especially noted because of the fact that the parallel or the equivalent literature that was is developed by in the broader community is not appropriate in large part for religious parents and children. So what is the status of his books? So some people are saying burn them with the chametz, and others are throwing them out, and others are saying keep them, and so on. So I would like to just put the discussion into context and to share with you my opinion. This is not certainly not a psak halacha, but what I think. In order to do so, I need to share with you a passage from the Talmud, which unfortunately I've had to teach in similar circumstances at least 3 times in the past number of years. The Talmud says, this is in Moed Katan 17a. Talmud says as follows. Hahu tzur mevar Rabbanan. There was a Talmid Chacham, there was a rabbinic scholar. Dahavusano Shumane, who had a very bad reputation. From hints scattered throughout the story, it's clear that he was guilty of some kind of sexual infraction, not indiscretions, infractions. Okay. Avusano Shumane. He had a really, really bad reputation. Amar Rav Yehuda. They were in Babylonia. Rav Yehuda, who was in the second generation of the Amoraim in Babylonia, we're talking the middle of the 3rd century, said, Hechi Liavid, what should we do with this guy? Lishamte, we can put him in Cherem, which is really the most severe punishment that Jews could give. So what should we do? On the one hand, he's a great scholar. If I put him in Cherem, all right, should we put him in Cherem? Should we excommunicate him? Which was the most severe penalty that could be given. It was a form of living death, and that's why a person who's excommunicated actually acts like a mourner, because he's mourning for himself. He is not part of a community. He's nowhere, actually. Later on, it becomes even worse, because in the Middle Ages, you needed to be part of a community to have some kind of legal standing. So if you were excommunicated, what ended up happening was you you either repented and got back to the community, or you had to convert to another religion. So this is really extreme. So he says, should we excommunicate him? Which means that he was worthy of being excommunicated. If that's the, I mean, there are lesser punishments when you give a maltract, a person who's a criminal. Chayrim in this period is as bad as it gets. So he says, l'shamte, if we excommunicate him, tzricha l'rabbanan, but he's a great scholar. Intellectually, he makes a tremendous contribution to the community. Lo shamte, if we don't excommunicate him, kamis chal shem shema d'shmaya. It'll accepting him, keeping him here, keeping him in his status as a teacher when we know he has such a horrible reputation. That's not. There's no greater desecration of the name of God. What, this person should teach Torah when we know all of the horrible things he does? I mean, from later on in the passage, it seems that he was sleeping with everything that moved. I mean, this is not a he can't represent the Torah. So what if he has knowledge? What good is this knowledge if it doesn't have moral and ethical moorings? On the other hand, apparently he was absolutely brilliant. And there is always a tendency to say, oh my God, he's so brilliant. We'll just give him a pass. The Gemara goes on. Amalei the Rabba Bar Bar Chana. So Rav Yehuda asked his colleague, Rabba Bar Bar Chana, Midi Shmielach Bahai? Are you aware of any traditions that have dealt with this situation? So he says, yeah, Dafka. I heard it from, in the name of the greatest sage in the previous generation in the land of Israel, Rabbi Yochanan. Amar lehachi amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said as follows. Mai dichtiv, he quotes a pasuk, he quotes a verse in Malachi. Kisifte kohen yishmeru dat. For the lips of the priest will guard knowledge, or will conserve knowledge. V'tara yivakshu mipiyu. And they should seek instruction from his mouth. Ki malach Hashem Tzvakotu, because he is an angel of the Lord of Hosts. Now, it's clear from the Torah that one of the major obligations, one of the major tasks of the priests, as far as the Bible is concerned, is to teach Torah. I mean, you see it explicitly. I mean, it's certainly true for the Levites also, but in the bracha. In the bracha that Moses gives at the end of his life to the various tribes, he says this explicitly. He says, "Ula Levi Amar," and he says to Levi, "Tumecha v'orecha liish chasidecha." The lighting things that the special accessory that the high priest wore, the Urim V'Tumim, which were sort of had a prognosticatory function. The Ish Chasidecha was given to your pious person, Asher Nisitav Masaso, and so forth. At the end, he says, Yoru Mishpatech LeYaakov, you, meaning the tribe of Levi, and certainly the Kohanim, should instruct your laws to Jacob, B'Torah Chal Yisrael, and your Torah to Israel, Yasimo b'tar k'tar b'pecha, and also they will also offer incense, and they will also serve the Beit HaMikdash. So part of the one of the major functions was of the Kohanim was teaching. So and you have earlier in the book of Malachi, in the same chapter of Malachi, a question is the prophet raises the question: is shalu me'akohanim Torah? You want to paskin, you want paskin v'shaili? You want to answer a legal question? Ask the priest. So that's what the pasuk means. Why do you ask him? So the answer at the end of that same verse is ki malach Hashem Tzvakotu, because he is the angel of the Lord of Hosts. In other words, he is the messenger of God to provide, to vouchsafe Torah and instruction and teaching to the people. Rabbi Yochanan understood Rabbi Yochanan actually understood the verse to mean something slightly different. The word ki in Hebrew can mean because. It can mean for. It can mean when. It can mean a number of different things. And he understood the verse ki malach Hashem tzvakot hu, he is angel. It can also mean when. So the simple meaning of the verse is, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. It can also mean ki when he is a messenger of the Lord of hosts. So in other words, go study or go seek teaching from the priest when he acts like an angel of God. So when Rabbi Yochanan interpreted im domeh harav lamalach Hashem, if the teacher. We're not talking about a schlepper. We're not talking about some third grade guy. Harav. We're talking about somebody important, somebody who's achieved. Yivakshu Torah mipiyu. If, like Caesar's wife, if the angel is above reproach, then we can study with him. Bim lav. If not, al yivakshu Torah mipiyu. Then under no circumstances should you study from such a person. The person's moral failings upend and disqualify every single thing the person ever taught. Now, one could perhaps only once the person started sinning, that's already a quibble. Okay? But if not, the person's moral standing and moral comportment is the determinative factor. Something. So Rav Yehuda accepted that interpretation, and he put this unnamed rabbi in Chayrim. He excommunicated him, and the rest of the story goes on about how he tried to do tshuva, and it wasn't very successful, and he died, and it's an entire story. It's not for now. This insight, this interpretation, the way I presented it, is explicitly noted by Maimonides, and it's mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the question then becomes, and so among the authorities that address this issue, the question comes up is, are we talking here about, is there a difference? Put it this way. Up until the 4th century, third century, everything, all of the oral law was oral, which means that if you wanted to study with such a person, you had to have a person, you had to have a direct contact with him. From that time on, first the Mishnah is written down, and then once the Talmud is completed in the 6th century, about 150, 200 years later, it's written down. So at that point, what happens is you can actually go and you can also make a distinction between a book and the person. If a person writes a book, I can judge his ideas based on the book. Whereas, and I don't need any contact with this rake, this person who is absolutely contemptible. And that argument has been raised in the past few days with regard to Walder, and it had been previously raised with regard to Mati Elon, who was actually the first time I ended up learning teaching this Gemara. Strikingly, I went through a very large group of earlier commentaries, Rishonim and Acharonim and Post, all kinds of people. And it was really, really striking. I was struck to find that overwhelmingly, all authorities do not make this distinction. That if a person is known to have been morally corrupt, if a person is known to have been criminally deficient, criminally guilty, that not only does the Torah ban having a direct contact with him and talking to him, by definition, he or her today also, I mean, we unfortunately know that there are abusers of both genders, that you should have nothing, not only should you have no direct person with them personally, it's inevitable that there personalities, and that their personae, more than personalities, are embedded in their works. And here the issue of at what point Did they start actually sinning or being pursuing criminal activity would be relevant. There is only one relatively unknown 19th century opinion which says that no, if you have a book, whatever the book is, it's distinct from the persona of the person. So if a person has a book, then melee shouldn't be so bad. Strikingly, however, even that individual says that's as far as a result, an adult is concerned, because here we're talking about advanced Torah studies. We'll get to Walder and the practical application in a minute. So this Achron named Yad Binyamin says that, look at, if you're talking about an adult, and you're not talking about coming in direct contact with a person who's morally condemnable, that an adult should be mature enough to be able to distinguish between good and bad and the things that he reads, and therefore there shouldn't be a problem. So that raises two issues in the case of Walder's books. One is basis of that, then books should not be given to children ever because children can't make that distinction. But then you could say this is not as a friend of mine who's a very prominent author pointed out, and quite correctly, if we were to start rejecting books because there's something wrong with the authors, we would be in serious trouble. Maybe this discussion is only restricted to Torah. Now, I agree with that. Certainly. Here, this gentleman whose bust sits on my table. His name is Dante Alighieri. Three copies of his great book I have on my shelf, the Commedia Divina. He was a blazing anti-Semite. And I think he wrote one of the most beautiful and important books of all time, The Divine Comedy. All right. But I can judge and use the book. And it's true of most, it's about history books and fantasy books. And somebody pointed out that Roald, nobody's going to stop reading James and the Giant Peach because Roald Dahl turns out was an anti-Semite. All that's true. I would suggest, however, that here we have a middle case. Because the books of Chaim Walder, they're not just literature. It's not just stories. The books serve a therapeutic or at least a semi-therapeutic function. And therefore, the way I see it, they're related to his persona and the perception of him as one of ours, as we would say. Meaning the Haredi community, the religious community, is integral to his success and to his effectiveness. Hence, especially since many of the books have implications there. There is an aura of religiosity which surrounds them for the simple reason that we're written for the Haredi community, for the ultra-Orthodox community, Orthodox, or the religious community in general. Hence, I don't think you can distinguish between the two, certainly not now. Certainly not now. Because, first of all, his crimes are just now still just coming out. And the person walked among us until last week. And he was a presence in public life, and he was a hero to many. And where the line was drawn between him and his creations, the line is not clear. So certainly, in the foreseeable future, I don't see any way that his crimes, these acts of abuse, in one case, it appears that he actually drove a young woman to suicide, the distinction can be made. Two generations from now, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what's going to be two generations, generations from now. But it seems to me very clear that at the moment, when the persona of Walder and his books exist on something of a spectrum, I don't see any way whatsoever that his books can be maintained, that his books can be sustained in a household. And there's something tragic about that, because they did serve a positive role. But maybe it will lead others to create in a similar vein, because the need has been demonstrated. Oh, okay. That's nothing. Oh, one thing I do want to mention before I'll just read the Mishnah. We'll talk a little bit about it. There is a fund that is being has been created by a remarkable woman named Abigail Heilbrunn for the victim to collect for the victims of Walder and for other victims of sexual abuse. It is all the money goes to the victims. And they're the ones who really should be considered first in all of this. The link for the donation will be in, I'll put it up on the, it's on my face. For those of you watching my Facebook page, it's on my Facebook page already. I will put the link on the, in the comments of the Tel Aviv International Synagogue link, where this is simultaneously broadcast. And please, if you can, give, even a token donation is a very big, it's a very big statement. A lot of us feel very frustrated, wish we could do something more. Here's something very tangible that you can do in order to advance the community to a better, more moral place. Okay, briefly, since we don't have a lot of time, briefly, let's look at the Mishnah that we were looking at. Is chapter 2, Mishnah 12. Rabbi Yossi, who was known as a Chassid, we talked about this last week, used to say, Yehi mamon chavercha chaviv alech kishalach, the wealth or the property of your friend or your fellow should, or your brother should be as dear to you as your own. V'atken atzmacha l'lmod Torah she'ena yerushalach. Prepare yourself, firm yourself to study Torah, because Torah is not acquired by inheritance. The whole concept, and then v'chol masecha yoshem shemayim, everything you do should be the sake of heaven. It's very striking that despite the fact that there is this concept of yichus, of coming from a good family, and that smart people have smart people, and that therefore if you're descended from a rabbi, you should be a great rabbi also, you should get some kind of precedence. The Mishnah here says explicitly that there is no, one does not inherit Torah, one has to achieve it on one's own, A. And B, historically, history has borne out the fact that any time that there are a hereditary succession in a Torah, in an Orthodox and religious institution, it doesn't work out well. In the Talmud, you have some children of sages who are great, but in general not. The later descendants of Hillel, who served as Nasiim, they were not the sharpest crayons on the box. One or two generations after Rashi, his grandchildren, were the Balei HaTosfos, they were outstanding. And at the same time, there's tons and tons and tons of Rashi. They're not all geniuses on Rashi's level. I don't know if any of them are green geniuses on Rashi's level. Especially in light of the fact that, as a friend of mine, Dr. Yaakov Guggenheim, once pointed out to me, at least 40% of all living Ashkenazim are descended from Rashi. So you can do the math. The same with the descendants of the Rambam. By the time you get a generation away or two generations away, they're okay. Nothing special. Torah is not Yerusha. Torah is not Yerusha. And when it becomes Yerusha, when Yichus becomes an issue, when pedigree becomes an issue, it can become a form of idolatry. My wife tells a story, or my late niece, sister-in-law, told a story when she was in Lubavitch School in Beis Rivka. It doesn't have to be. It happens to be in Beis Rivka in Brooklyn, that there was a little girl came into the class and said to the girls, You have to stand up to me because I'm nine generations from the Baal Shem Tov. Seven years old little kid. Who the hell cares who you descended from? That doesn't prove anything. So that this idea that the Torah should be achieved by its on its own, by your own efforts, and you should be evaluated and appreciated that way, is very much a historically borne out fact. On the other hand, I don't think I mentioned this when we talked about the status of Rebbelezer ben Horkanus as a something of a Balshuva, right? He came from a wealthy family. He wasn't religious, but he certainly came from a scholarly family. And he had break-in and all of the frustration. And we discussed the possibility, I think, that a lot of his frustrations, a lot of the trials that he went through were a result that he wasn't part of the cool crowd initially. Although Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai had the sharpness of perception to realize that he should take this guy in and make him a student, which he did. The clannishness and the overemphasis on yichus in the Jewish community, in the Orthodox community, particularly the last few hundred years, it stands in stark contrast to this Mishnah, and I think is actually a negative factor therein, but that's for another time. Next week we'll talk about, I hope, happier things. The next mission talks about Kriyat Shema and Tefillah, so that's actually a plus. And we will see you next time. Please feel free to share this. It's going to be on the Tel Aviv International Synagogue website, Facebook page. It'll be on my YouTube channel. Audiovisual version will be on YU Torah, and questions, comments are always welcome. I get comments every week from a certain number of people, and I'm very much appreciative. But please, let's make this into a conversation rather than just a presentation. And in the meantime, we will see you, in any case, in the meantime, we will see you next time.